WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to spend most of today's program talking about the next installment in the PBS series American Experience. This program continues to bring to the world one fantastic documentary after another. This next film, which is airing Monday night on PBS stations across the country, including Channel 10 in Milwaukee, is a film that is really quite uncommon in its theme and its approach. The film is called Riveted, The History of Jeans. It's a look at an item of clothing that most of us really take completely for granted. But this film traces the intriguing history of jeans. Where did they come from? Who deserves credit for inventing them? Is it possible to even know? And in particular, how the blue jean has, in a sense, interwoven itself with our own country's cultural history. There is something so very American about blue jeans, and yet the people who have chosen to wear jeans over the course of successive generations has been profoundly different. And again, it's the kind of thing that has been, in a sense, right in front of us, staring us in the face, but the story has never been told in such fascinating fashion as it is in this particular film. My morning show guest, Michael Bix, is the co-writer, co-director, and co-producer of this marvelous film. And we're going to be talking about his filmmaking career and then talking about this very specific film and the fun that I'm sure he is and his colleagues had in putting it together. Michael Bix, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I really enjoy speaking with documentarians over the years. They're among my greatest pleasures in hosting this program, and for all the things that I love to do in my own life, if there's anybody I envy, it is documentarians. I mean, it just seems like such fascinating work. I think this is our first opportunity to speak, you and I, so I would love to hear a little bit more about your overall career before we talk specifically about this latest film called Riveted. When did your interest in making films begin, and then when specifically did you start to fall in love with the idea of making documentary films specifically?
Well, I have an odd career path. Whenever I go talk to like high school or college students, I always say, if you know what you want to do in your life, you're ahead of the game. And I was at graduate school at MIT in urban planning, and it was a very, very bad fit for me. And I was sitting in a class one day, and I was thinking, what in the world am I doing here? And it occurred to me, if somebody came down to me at that moment and said I could do anything in the world, what would the answer be? And it immediately was, make documentaries. So I quit graduate school and sort of went on a long path that started at ABC News and involved being Peter Jennings' researcher and covering breaking news and war. And eventually, after about 15 years of working at ABC, I worked my way up to making documentaries. And I've been doing it, I don't know, probably for the last 20 years. I mean, hour-long or two-hour-long films.
Now, why is it at that point in time when you realized that the grad school thing was going very poorly and you really needed to think about something else to do, why is it that making documentary films popped into your head? I mean, were you someone who loved to watch them, maybe? Or was there something else in your life that would suggest that that was a logical thing for you to pursue?
Well, I loved movies. I had worked as a photo editor of my college newspaper, and I liked still photography, but I thought it'd be much more fun if they moved. And I didn't know anything about making documentaries, so I was always like, how in the world am I going to do it? But it was just all, I mean, it just seemed like a very interesting way to spend one's life, which it certainly has been. But it just sort of, I mean, it never really occurred to me that that's what I wanted to do, but it just popped into my head the minute I said, if somebody came down right now and said you could do anything in the world, what would it be? And that just, I mean, it wasn't like I thought about it before. It just popped into my head, and I said, well, you're right. That's what you want to do, so go do it.
Fascinating. I know that one of the films, to your credit, is The Beatles Revolution. Can you just talk a moment about that particular film?
And years and years ago at ABC, a fellow named David Saltz, who was a big producer, somehow had made a deal with George Martin where they got tape and interviews. And me and, like, a raft of people, like, produced a two-hour show. But that was one where it's fairly safe. I was a mechanic. In other words, there are other people in charge, and I was just given a little chunk of it to work on.
Right. I think that's maybe an example of how some documentary films can be highly collaborative amongst a whole lot of people, and other films can be more of a sort of personal statement and a personal vessel. What would be some of those films in your career that we should know about?
Well, I did a series years ago called In the Jury Room, where we actually had access to juries in murder cases and in a death penalty case. And that was something that was certainly a project of passion. It took 2 years to convince everybody to let us do it in terms of all the lawyers. So, I mean, there's that one. I did a show about the computer that played Jeopardy called Smartest Machine on Earth. Just recently did one with my partner, Annalise Strachan, called Memory Hackers, about what is memory. I've done a whole range of things, but I love all those.
Hmm. So when it comes to making a given documentary film, how often are you generating the idea versus responding to someone else's idea that such and such would be great fodder for a wonderful documentary?
It goes back and forth. With this one, Anna Lee, who I've worked with for the last 10 years, father used to work for Levi's. And Anna Lee is a very fashion-conscious young woman, and she's always been curious about jeans. And so she just sort of, one day we were talking to the executive producer of American Experience. We had a bunch of ideas on the table. And Annalise said, I've always been interested in jeans. And Cameo George, who's the executive producer, her ears perked up and said, yeah, that sounds sort of cool. Go look into it. We knew nothing about it outside of jeans. And then just started to look at it. And sometimes people will come to you. So that one we generated. But sometimes, like, the folks at Nova years ago said, we want to do a show about memory. Like, what is memory? You know? And that was it. I mean, it was just, you know, you're basically given the word and you have to go figure it out. So sometimes, the ideas generally are pretty loose. It's not like somebody comes to you with sort of a specific thing, but somebody will say, we want to do something about memory. And then you have to go figure it out.
Right. And I suppose in the case of this film, in terms of exploring the history of blue jeans, I'm guessing that right at the outset, at least, didn't perhaps occur to you that the history of the blue jeans could also end up being, in a sense, the history of the United States sort of seen through the lens of blue jeans? I mean, or did that occur to you very early that that would be the framework within which this film should be made?
I mean, certainly when the idea came up, it did not occur to us about how much American history could be encompassed by a pair of pants. But, I mean, once we got into it even a little bit, you suddenly look in this and go, oh, my word, you know? And then it just sort of keeps revealing itself, really. So, I mean, pretty early on in the process, we realized that something that was a lot more than a pair of pants.
We're speaking with Michael Bix. He is co-writer, co-producer, co-director of the next American Experience documentary film. It's called Riveted, The History of Jeans. Maybe you could take us a little bit inside the process of in general, but also specifically with this new film, Riveted. What is that initial stage like in which you have to figure out what this film in general is going to look like? I mean, does it involve hours of sitting around a table, batting ideas back and forth, or just what is the outset of this process like, particularly with something like Riveted, in terms of figuring out what this film in general is going to be?
Well, generally, the first phase is what I refer to as the carpet bombing phase, where you go and you just start like looking around and find everybody's possible name who could have something to say about it. And you sort of call one person and think, well, no, they're not that interesting. And you call somebody else and they're very interesting. And they say, but, you know, if you really want to know about it, you got to talk to that person. And I don't know, we make like 80, 90, tons and tons of phone calls and just talk to people. And in the process of it, the story emerges. But it's just, I mean, you call up people who know about it and talk to them, and you just learn stuff you never knew. And then you figure out, okay, how do I incorporate this into a film? And after those initial conversations, you sort of write an outline of the show and then show it to your bosses and say, this is what we think we're doing. And they sort of think about it a little and say, oh, that's pretty good, but if I were you, I'm a little more interested in this. Hmm. And then we go out and shoot the interviews, construct the show.
At what point did PBS and American Experience become part of the process? I mean, did you have to...
I mean, I'm a little... I'm unusual in that I work when people pay me to work. In other words, well, that's not true. We're developing an idea right now, but outside of maybe spending a few weeks developing an idea, want to go to people and make sure that they're going to actually give you the money to do it. So with this one, they're interested, and we maybe spent 2 weeks of our own time sort of just reading a couple books and writing them a very general pitch, which was maybe like 30% of what the show ended up being. And on the basis of that pitch, they said, okay, go do it. And then that's when we really started to go at it.
Were you concerned as you went to PBS? I mean, we often think of American Experience as the story of the building of the Grand Canal or the assassination of James Garfield or so on. I mean, that's what we most immediately think of with American Experience. Were you at all concerned that about how this suggestion would be received, or did you see right from the start that this was perfect material for PBS and American Experience?
Well, I mean, you're right that some of what American Experience does. Years ago, they did a show on Tupperware, which was won an Emmy and I think a Peabody, and it won a lot of things. And it was about just what you could learn about through a specific object. And so you knew that they'd done something like this before. And also, to be that that our idea coincided with the new executive producer coming on board, who is, younger and wanted to do slightly different things. So it just sort of, it was kismet. I mean, she was interested, and we knew that they'd done something about an object before that worked out for them. So it just, they were interested.
Very good. Yeah. I'm speaking with filmmaker Michael Bix, who is co-director, co-producer, co-writer of the newest PBS American Experience documentary film airing Monday night on Channel 10 in Milwaukee and on PBS stations across the country. It's titled Riveted, The History of Jeans. One of the most interesting things your film tells us is the somewhat murky story behind who deserves credit for inventing blue jeans. That although the myth, I think, as it's sort of characterized in the film, is that it's the creation of one Levi Strauss, that in fact there, long before Mr. Strauss came along, there were garments that looked a little bit like blue jeans all over the world, in fact. Tell us a little bit about this aspect of the story and how surprised you were to find out just how kind of indistinct the earliest history of the blue jeans, in fact, is.
I'm not sure I was surprised, just because, I mean, everything about America, I mean, America is pretty, you know, I mean, if you look far enough back, it's often hard to get a clear picture. But the thing about jeans is nobody knows exactly where they started. I mean, they know that in Dungaree, India, you know, where the word dungarees come from, spelled a little differently, that there was a coarse fabric made in the 2/1 twill, which is jeans. It was made out of cotton called dungaree. And then somehow that fabric or the same idea arose a little, 100 years later or so in Italy, in Genoa, where Christopher Columbus's father, or at least that's how the story is told, made a coarse cotton cloth in Genoa, which was called jean. And some of it was used for sails, and some of it was used for pants. And somehow that fabric then made its way to Denim, France, where the word denim comes from, and they, you know, made more of it. And then when the mills in America, you know, pick up, like where I live in New Hampshire around the beginning of the 19th century, they suddenly just start churning this stuff out by the bolts. And that's where sort of, I mean, jeans or denim as we know it in America started. So back then, denim was not always cotton. I mean, the thing that distinguished it was this 2/1 twill. If you look at the backside of your jeans, you'll see they're not blue, they're white. And that's because of the way that sort of there are two white threads and one blue thread. And that twill fabric makes it very, very strong. And as American cotton manufacturing grew, they switched from like a wool cotton blend or stuff like that basically to cotton, which is where we get the cotton denim that we know today.
Mm. I really am glad that your film takes a few minutes to talk about this wondrous thing called indigo and mm-hmm. indigo dye, which is absolutely essential in the creation of what we think of as truly blue jeans.
Yeah.
Tell our listeners a little bit about what makes indigo so intriguing.
Well, I mean, what makes indigo intriguing is, well, first of all, I mean, there's the color blue, which people, you know, the sky is blue. You know, I mean, blue, for some reason, is considered, you know, true blue is considered a very pure color, and people are attached to it. And indigo originally was, like, grown in Africa and India. I mean, it's a weed, and it turning that weed into the blue dye is a very, very complicated thing. And back in the, I guess, you know, 16th, 17th century, it was, you know, incredibly valuable, in some spots considered worth its weight in gold. And when the United States colonies were, particularly the ones in the South, were looking for a cash crop, they discovered that the enslaved folks that they brought over for Africa had the knowledge of how to produce this thing called indigo. And this woman named Eliza Lucas was sort of in South Carolina, you know, who sort of had this interest in botany, and her, you know, father sent her, you know, who was a colonial governor, said, you know, hey, some of the enslaved folks that are coming over from Antigua, where I'm the colonial governor, had the knowledge about how to grow this thing, I think you'd be curious about it. And Eliza Lucas was, and sort of oversaw this, you know, group of folks on her farm who started to produce indigo. Now, the crazy thing about this story, which is actually not that crazy if you think about United States history, is, of course, the enslaved got no credit for bringing indigo into the country. I mean, it was Eliza Lucas. I mean, she's the first woman inducted into the South Carolina Business Persons Hall of Fame because she took the crop from nothing, from basically a weed, to it being the second largest cash crop in South Carolina. And if, you know, one Google, I mean, she's taught in textbooks, stuff like that. And yet the knowledge of how to produce this crop came from the enslaved. Hmm. Now, of course, indigo is, now, you know, on very expensive genes it's used, but somewhere around the 1910 or so, they discovered that there was synthetic indigo, which was a lot cheaper. But, I mean, there's still indigo blue, but, I mean, real indigo was not being used except for, you know, $250 pair of Japanese jeans.
But indigo, of course, plays a really important role in kind of the emergence of this and the story behind this famous woman, Eliza Lucas, is of the slaves who actually knew how to do this. Slaves play an interesting role in the early history of blue jeans in another way. Your film tells us about one way in which we know for a fact that many North American slaves were wearing blue jeans. Explain to our listeners how it is that this is documented. This is fascinating.
Well, there's something. First of all, just speaking for my Gen Z daughters, got to use the word enslaved. That, like, you can't use slaves anymore. It's got to be the word enslaved. Because, anyway, but the way that we know that the enslaved were wearing them was there was something called the Freedom on the Move date. Well, there is something, I think it's run by Cornell University, called the Freedom on the Move database. And the Freedom on the Move database takes something called runaway slave ads, which, you know, it's hard to imagine, but whenever the enslaved, I mean, ran away, their owners would put ads in the paper looking for them. And so, and one of the things that they would do is sort of say, I'm looking for, like, you know, I mean, Michael Bix, 5'8", going bald, left wearing, and they would describe exactly what the guy was wearing. And time after time, you saw that they were wearing jeans pants or jeans coats or a jean frock. And it just kept coming up and up and up. So we know that way that the enslaved were wearing jeans. Also, the other thing we know is that one of the largest markets for the mills, you know, in New England was for something called Negro cloth, or Negro or slave cloth. And Negro or slave cloth also was denim. And they would, you'd see tons of ads for, you know, from dry goods salesmen saying, we've got, like, bolts of that, you know, this kind of Negro cloth, this kind of Negro cloth. So we know it from two different sort of sources in the 19th century.
Your film eventually tells us about a certain gentleman by the name of Jacob Davis. And this is a name that most people don't know. They will more likely know the name of his ultimate business partner, Levi Strauss. But I'm so glad that your film tells us about this humble tailor in Reno, Nevada, Jacob Davis. Tell us why he figures in the history of blue jeans.
Well, I mean, as we've been talking, I mean, jeans were around throughout the 19th century. But the problem with them was they ripped. And they kept, like, ripping and sort of falling apart. And, you know, and they'd rip at distress points. And so anyway, this guy, Jacob Davis in Reno, Nevada, who is a tailor, somebody, like, some woman walks in off the street and says to him, you know, I got a portly husband who constantly is ripping his pants. And can you make a pair that won't rip? And Davis looks around and notices that there's some, like, rivets that they use to repair saddles. And this light bulb goes off over the guy's head. And he goes, what happened if I put these rivets in the stress points in the pants. And he does. And, you know, if you look at your jeans, you can see that they got rivets, you know, right around the front. I mean, they still do. And anyway, this took off. And people suddenly, like, all over Reno, Nevada, like miners and farmers and stuff like that were going, I want a pair of those pants. Jacob Davis was just a guy. And he got the denim that he was using to rivet together from Levi Strauss. And Levi Strauss was a pretty big-time dry goods salesman, had a huge store in San Francisco. And Davis goes to Levi Strauss and says, listen, I got this idea. You know, if you put rivets in pants, you know, we can sell like a boatload of them, but I haven't got the money to get a patent. So I'll make a deal with you. If you, you know, put in for the patent, we can go into business as partners. And they do. And for 18 years, I mean, they were the sole seller of riveted pants, which just took off like wildfire in the West.
Hmm. You tell us that once the patents do expire, then all kinds of other companies spring up seemingly overnight. Yep. And the vast majority of them we've never heard of, but you were able to dig up old ads and so on that bear the names of some of these companies that rushed in to try to take over part of the market for blue jeans. One of the things that you discuss in the film is how some of this coincides with a point in time in American history when there is rising resentment for the influx of people from other countries, in particular people from China. Explain what one would see in the advertisements for many companies making blue jeans at this point in time in terms of who was making those jeans.
Well, I mean, it wasn't only the advertisements. I mean, it was literally on those like pieces of leather on the back. I mean, they would say made by white labor only, because in the early 20th century, there was, early 20th century, there was a huge backlash against Chinese labor and a huge sort of prejudice against the Chinese. And Samuel Gompers, who is like the head of the AFL-CIO, just went on this tirade about how the Chinese were taking away American work. And so they would literally, on your jeans, including Levi's, would say the only kind made by white labor, but which was unfortunately not true. A lot of them were made only by white labor.
One of the things that we are shown in the film is that as America's sort of cultural profile begins to shift to being more and more of an urban nation, the blue jean plays a really important role in kind of our collective life. Explain what's going on in America and how blue jeans play a role in that.
Well, I mean, it's more, I think, with the Great Depression. I mean, you're right, as America's becoming more urban. But, well, as it becomes more urban, there is sort of this nostalgia for this past that never existed. You know, this, like, sort of past where, like, there were cowboys wearing blue jeans and stuff like that. So that helped with blue jeans, this large nostalgia. But then during the Great Depression, suddenly the Westerns, like, pick up on this sort of nostalgia for the past and start, I mean, thousands of films with cowboys. And of course, all those cowboys are wearing jeans. And suddenly jeans sort of become symbolic of this mythical, tough America that really only sort of existed.
This is when we begin to see, in particular, certain upper-class women who begin wearing blue jeans at a time when they go on kind of special trips out west. This is something that, of course, is pretty much vanished from the scene, and especially people of a certain age are going to not have any idea or a recollection of what we're talking about. Explain this interesting kind of vacation and how many of these women came to wear blue jeans at a time when women in general wearing pants was frowned upon to some extent.
Well, I mean, one has to remember that even in the 1930s, basically, the people who were wearing jeans were people who were working for a living. I mean, you know, they were wearing these pants because they were like the toughest things to wear to work. And during the 1930s, a lot of cattle ranches were basically decimated by the Great Depression. And so they realized that they could make money by basically turning themselves into so-called dude ranches and advertising themselves to sort of rich, and particularly rich women from back east to sort of come out and like help with the chores and like, you know, ogle the cowhands and just spend like a month, you know, or two on these ranches doing work. And the women who came out there, of course, what did they wear but jeans? And suddenly, you know, jeans, I mean, like Vogue magazine picks up, I mean, it became a huge trend that there were all these women in the Depression going out to these dude ranches across the West. And you had to be quite wealthy to go there because, you know, you had to take a train. I mean, you had to have the money to do it. And all these women were wearing jeans. And they then come back east with these jeans and sort of start showing them off. And somehow Vogue and Levi's noticed this, and Levi's starts manufacturing a pair of pants called Lady Levi's, which are the first pants made, specifically denim pants, made just for women. And they end up in the page of Vogue. And suddenly jeans go from being workwear to suddenly being a fashion statement.
Hmm. And, of course, in some respects, the rest is history. But that history continues to go on and change through subsequent generations. And I just love the way that your film takes us through various stages, various generations in which very different constituents, if you will, are wearing mm-hmm. jeans and making a statement. Give our listeners at least a sketch of what we see in the film from this point on.
Well, I mean, you know, we go to World War II, and of course, Rosie the Riveter, where women were like wearing jeans like crazy. And World War II is pivotal for jeans because all of the, you know, sort of troops that went overseas, a lot of them either in the Navy, they wore jeans on the ship, or when they were off, often the Army would issue them jeans, and suddenly all of these soldiers come back home with jeans. And suddenly, you know, jeans are like, you know, are all over the place. And then kids pick them up as sort of a symbol of rebellion in the 50s. You know, part of it has to do with Marlon Brando and things like that. And then suddenly they become sort of the marker of youth rebellion, which they've sort of been on and off for a long time. I think one of the most fascinating things, though, in the film, at least for me, was the story of the civil rights movement. Because we always think that, all right, we think jeans were sort of a garment of protest in the 1960s, but where did that get that start? I mean, people think, oh, it's got to be the hippies, right? And it turns out that there were a group of middle-class black college students who were often going to, like, historically black colleges who all traveled down south to sort of join the civil rights movement and particularly register voters in the South. And the people that they were trying to register were like sharecroppers and poor. I mean, the disenfranchised. And when they went down South to do this, to sort of show solidarity with the disenfranchised, they started wearing their uniform, which was denim. I mean, it was often overalls or things like that. And then when white college students came down to join the civil rights movement in the South, they started putting on jeans too. And jeans in the early 60s during the civil rights movement became a very potent symbol of protest. And then when these white kids go back north, they're wearing those jeans, and jeans sort of become the emblem of protest in the 60s.
It's a fascinating story. Ahead of that, I don't think you mentioned a moment when the companies that made jeans felt the need to create something called the Denim Council to help boost sales. Explain why sales of jeans plunged so drastically and the kind of things that these companies did to try to repair the sort of the public profile and image and reputation of blue jeans.
Okay, well, when some of those soldiers came back from World War II, a bunch of them, I mean, some of them who, you know, didn't feel like just sort of going back into the 9-to-5 world, started riding motorcycles. And, you know, they were wearing denim when they were riding motorcycles. And you get sort of the rise of, like, motorcycle clubs. And these clubs are then sort of the movie Hollywood looks and goes, wow, that looks sort of cool. And they start making movies like The Wild One, you know, where Marlon Brando is, like, riding a motorcycle and goes in and, like, terrorizes the town. And he's wearing denim. And suddenly teenagers look around at this and go, whoa, denim, that's really cool. I want to be a bad boy like Marlon Brando. And so suddenly you have, like, teenagers who are, like, wearing it and wearing it and wearing it. And this being the 1950s where people are, you know, a little uptight, I guess is how one might put it, suddenly the school systems start looking around and going, oh, my God, we've got all these kids wearing denim. They're, like, imitating Marlon Brando. They're hoodlums. They're hoodlums. So school systems start banning denim. The denim companies get really worried. They're like, uh-oh, you know, because they're like, they're banning denim because they think it's like hoodlums, juvenile delinquent, stuff like that. And the denim companies are like, uh-oh, this is going to, like, you know, really hurt a good thing. Like, sales are doing well. So they form something called the Denim Council, where they start making all these PSAs about the history of denim, you know, going back to, like, Christopher Columbus and the cowboys, and just sort of making it seem like it's an all-American thing. And the Denim Council goes as far as actually creating the uniform for the Peace Corps, you know, saying, all right, these are, like, good, you know, scrubbed college students who are going out to do good in the world. Put them in denim, get pictures taken. It'll help us. And it did until the 60s happened, and then suddenly they got another problem, which is the hippies.
And, of course, you explore and show us a lot of examples of the way in which jeans were worn in that era and how jeans would often be radically, in more ways than one, transformed by the wearer to be even more sort of specific and individual expressions of who one was, and of course that whole rebellious nature and so on. Ultimately, when we pass through all of that, we enter a new era in which the fashion industry begins creating a whole notion of designer jeans, which had never happened before. I mean, they'd never been looked at in that particular way. Explain what happens to the blue jeans in this particular era and why that happens or how that happens.
Well, you know, there's a couple ways. I mean, the short answer is it goes from being sort of like hippie garb to being sort of very fashionable. And the question is, why did that happen? And part of it, I think, is that the way that sort of American capitalism works is when something is dangerous, like, you know, like you look at the hippies and those outfits, the easiest way to sort of, and I'm not thinking that anybody actually consciously decides this, but the easiest way to deal with something as dangerous is to commodify it and sort of put it into the mainstream because it sort of defangs something that was dangerous. And I think that in many respects is what the American fashion industry was doing with jeans because, I mean, the hippies wore them and suddenly, like, the fashion industry looks at this and goes, oh, my word, there's a market for this. And they just start cranking out jeans. And then, I mean, everybody sort of knew that jeans were hot, but the fashion industry sort of took the, like, sexy aspect of jeans and went completely nuts with it. I mean, anybody who's like me, who was around in the 70s, remembers all these ads, which were, if I can say this, all about the butt. You know, I mean, they were just like, the blue jeans were just sort of very tight, very form-fitting, and they were really selling jeans as being like sexy clothes. And it was huge for them. I mean, huge. And I don't know if you're old enough to remember the Calvin Klein ad with Brooke Shields.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Oh, I mean, that one, where I mean, it's like we look at that today and it looks like child pornography. But you had this, I believe she's a 14 or 15-year-old woman who was like in the tightest footing. A fitting pair of jeans, who looks at the camera, and this is a TV ad, and she just looks at and says, do you know what gets between me and my Calvins? Nothing. And it just, I mean, sales of his jeans skyrocketed.
Well, and it's so interesting to think about jeans on Brooke Shields versus who, by and large, was wearing blue jeans back in 1860. I mean, the setting is different. The person is different. I mean, and the garment, to some extent, is different. And yet, they're all blue jeans. But it's just amazing to think about that dramatic transformation.
Well, yeah, no, it is. I mean, it is. And, of course, the gender is different. I mean, suddenly women are wearing blue jeans. But that's the cool thing about jeans, which is, I mean, they are like this canvas in which you can project your life onto, you know? And so, I mean, back in mid-19th century, I mean, while people didn't, I don't think, wore them to project, they just project anything onto them. They just wore them because they had to. But now, I mean, like, do you have a favorite pair of, like, what kind of jeans do you wear?
I mostly wear Lee.
But Lee, okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you've worn Lee for years, right?
Right, right.
And, okay, do you wear them because they say anything about you?
I think all they say is that they're so incredibly comfortable. I should also mention that I never wore jeans when I was young. In fact, I didn't wear jeans. I owned my first pair of jeans, I'm pretty sure, long after I got married. And I think it's because the one and only time as a child I put on blue jeans, they were dark blue and really coarse and felt horrible. I mean, they hadn't been broken in at all, and they just felt horribly stiff to me, you know, the way some jeans can be if they're really made to be durable. And I just couldn't imagine that blue jeans were comfortable. Plus, I was a pretty straight-laced kid growing up, very straight-laced.
Yeah.
And so my wife eventually persuaded me that, you know, jeans are not like that. You'd probably love wearing jeans. And of course, I finally agreed, and she was right. And I especially wear Lee blue jeans because they just feel the most comfortable to me. I just love the way they feel.
Yep, and there was something slightly liberating about learning that you liked jeans.
Yeah,
right?
you're absolutely right. That was, for me, letting my hair down to some extent.
And so you can project something about yourself on a pair of pants. You know, now I mean, that's why they keep going on. You know, I've always worn 501s. I mean, I've worn 501s since Levi 501s since I was like 13 years old. I mean, back in the day where you had, and some of your listeners remember this, where the rumor was they were called shrink to fit. So you had to get in a hot shower to get them to shrink to your body because they would shrink. And I was long haired at the end of the hippie generation. And have just always loved these pants. And I love them both because they have a past, but also they're comfortable.
You put those together, it's irresistible.
Yes.
Absolutely. When, of course, your film takes us even past the era of designer jeans through the era in which R&B artists take jeans and wear them in very, very different ways, and the statements continue. I want to ask you as we close about what it's like for documentarians like yourself to go excavating for all of the amazing things that you find. I mean, all the way from ads for jeans from the mid-19th century to old TV commercials and all kinds of other things and all kinds of photographs in which we've never stopped to really look at what are those people wearing in that photograph. Oh, my gosh, it's blue jeans. Take us inside the process by which you unearth all of this material and then the process by which you figure out how you're going to use it.
Well, the answer is you don't do it by yourself. In other words, I mean, we have a team, and part of our team is a woman named Melissa Pollard, who is a very, very good archival producer. And the archival producer, their job is just to, like, find stuff, you know? And you sort of, like, lay out the story, and then they go, like, deep into the depths of the Library of Congress and all over the place and find the pictures. And then we had a wonderful editor named Brian Funk who then takes, I mean, what we tend to do is rough out the script, you know, rough out all the sound and sort of say, this is the story we want to tell. And then we give that the editor the sound, Melissa gives him all the pictures, and then it sort of comes, and then it comes back, and you take a look and go, wow. And it's a really collaborative thing.
Well, I think you've shaped the film in really remarkable fashion, and I found that I learned so much through the making of this film and the viewing of it. And again, one of the things that that your film talks about right at the outset is we don't think about why half the world's population wears jeans. I mean, yeah, it's everywhere. For this thing that we think of as quintessentially American, it's something that's all over the planet. And I suppose that's a great pleasure for a filmmaker, is to take a look at something that we so completely take for granted otherwise.
But it is. But the most rewarding thing about this, though, is, I mean, if you can change the way that people see the world slightly in a film, you've done something. And this film, I really think that every time people put on their pants, anybody who sees this, who put on their pair of jeans, they're going to think about something as they put on those pants. And that's an amazing opportunity, you know, is to have sort of a simple object that's in everybody's life be something that really can open their window to a part of the world that they never really thought about.
Well, I think your film indeed does accomplish that, and very, very impressively. And we want to remind our listeners that this film is going to be the next film airing on PBS for the American Experience series. That will be Monday evening on PBS stations across the country, including Channel 10 in Milwaukee. The film, again, titled Riveted, The History of Jeans. And it's actually just under an hour long, but it's incredible how much is packed into this fascinating film. I loved it start to finish. The co-director, co-producer, co-writer, Michael Bix. Michael Bix, congrats on a fantastic film, and thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. What a pleasure.
Thank you for having me, and tune in. You'll love it. It's riveting.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I'm excited to share with you an interview that I'm actually recording a little later this morning with science writer Greg Branicup. He's a staff scientist and cosmochemist at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. His work has appeared in Science Magazine, Nature, and his most recent book is called Impact: How Rocks from Space Led to Life, Culture, and Donkey Kong. It's a wide-ranging and very, very entertaining look at meteors, meteorites, and their impact in more ways than one on our planet and on our history as human beings. That's tomorrow on The Morning Show. Thursday, I'm very excited to share with you an interview that I'll also be recording a little later this morning with Dr. Leslie Walker, who is the Dean of Arts and Humanities at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. The reason for our conversation is that this spring marks the 10th anniversary of the opening of that beautiful facility at Parkside that's known affectionately as the RITA, the RITA Talent Pickin Regional Center for Arts and Humanities. And in honor of that 10th anniversary, UW-Parkside has organized a number of different events to celebrate the occasion. I have fond memories of 10 years ago when I served as Master of Ceremonies for the dedication of the RITA. And I've been there many times over the last decade to enjoy various theatrical and musical performances. So we'll be talking about the Rita, its last 10 years, and what's ahead on Thursday's morning show. And on Friday, Stan Witzman, the author of a book called Coach, which chronicles the lives and the philosophy of more than 150 different coaches in a wide-ranging